This is the first day of this February 2015 two-day session, and I'm going to read from a book by a teacher named Bhante Gunaratana. It's called Mindfulness in Plain English. It comes out of the Vipassana tradition, and so of course I'll have to struggle to translate into the true language of Zen, but I think we can manage. Roshi's read from this book, actually. He gave a talk a while back, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years ago, on breath practice. And at the time, he said it was the first time he'd ever done that, which is kind of interesting because everyone who begins a practice of Zen at this center anyway, almost always starts out with the breath practice. So fundamental, and so much of that, of course, still applies, even if you're working on a koan or some other practice. When he gave that talk, there was one particular section that just, for me, was like a silver bullet through the forehead. And I've always been wanting to get back to this, and finally had the intelligence to buy the book. And here it is. A little bit about the author. It says here, Bhante Henopala, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, Gunaratana, was ordained at the age of 12 as a Buddhist monk in Malandania, Sri Lanka. In 1947, at the age of 20, he was given higher ordination in Kandy, and it goes on to talk about his college education and whatnot, and missionary work for the Mahabodhi Society. He's got quite a career of service, and ended up in this country. He served as the general secretary of the Buddhist Vihara Society of Washington, D.C. Came to this country in 68 to do that, and became the president of that society in 1980. This book is pretty well known. I was looking at some article in Tricycle recently that listed the 10 most influential Buddhist books. Get them now. And this was one of them. And I think it's a good book to have on that list. I'm going to start off reading a chapter that's entitled Attitude. He begins it with a rather questionable extrapolation from quantum physics that I'm going to skip. there's something about meditators appropriating the insights of quantum physics and extrapolating, and sometimes it's embarrassing. But when they start talking about mind, they are on solid ground, so to speak. He says, the mind itself is a set of events, and you participate in those events every time you look inward. Meditation is participatory observation. What you are looking at responds to the process of looking. In this case, what you are looking at is you, and what you see depends on how you look. Thus, the process of meditation is extremely delicate, and the result depends absolutely on the state of mind of the meditator. In traditional Buddhist practice, this whole question of attitude is emphasized more than maybe we do in Zen. And there's some value to that. The attitudes that we bring into practice can have quite an effect for good or for bad. We can be limited very much by unconscious attitudes that we hold in our practice, as we'll see as we go further into this. And it's worth taking a little time to just have an idea of what we're carrying with us. He says the following attitudes are essential to success in practice. Most of them have already been presented, that is earlier in the book, but we bring them together again here as a series of rules for application. So, number one, don't expect anything. Okay, no problem, check. Just sit back and see what happens. Treat the whole thing as an experiment. Actually, there's a passage from Anthony DeMello that I'll probably trot out later that gets into that, that I've read before. But that basic attitude is so wonderful, to look at not only your practice, look at your life as an experiment. It's an ongoing experiment, and when we can sort of detach and stand back and look at it in that way, it works much better than when it's an exercise in trying to get what we want and trying to avoid what we hate. He says, take an active interest in the test itself, but don't get distracted by your expectations about the results. For that matter, don't be anxious for any result whatsoever. Let the meditation move along at its own speed and in its own direction. Let the meditation teach you. Meditative awareness seeks to see reality exactly as it is. Whether that corresponds to our expectations or not, it does require a temporary suspension of all our preconceptions and ideas. When you're talking to people, to be able just to listen without filling in the blanks. There's so much more that we see when we just, by not expecting, we're getting ourselves out of the way. We're allowing things to bloom and come forth. He says, don't strain. It's number two. Don't force anything or make grand, exaggerated efforts. Meditation is not aggressive. There is no place or need for violent striving. Just let your effort be relaxed and steady. I think in Japanese Zen, there is sort of an element of not violent striving, but there may be a place for what the Chinese called angry determination. But it's very delicate. It's really, really far more common when people start to turn up the heat for them to start tripping over themselves. Remember somebody telling me that he went to Doksan once with Roshi Kaplow, and he was a little down on himself because, unlike the people around him, he wasn't bellowing moo all the time, and thought that maybe he wasn't somehow finding a way to give it his all like others seem to be doing. And Roshi Kaplow told him, you know, the loudest people have the worst practice. The key point is not to force anything, not to stand outside yourself and decide how I've got to do this. If you just come into it with that open attitude of an experiment to see what's there, then everything naturally develops. The process opens up on its own. His third point is, don't rush. There is no hurry, so take your time. Settle yourself on a cushion and sit as though you have the whole day. And you do. Anything really valuable takes time to develop. Patience, patience, patience. But just by definition, you know, any kind of impatience, any kind of rushing is looking beyond this moment. The minute you start to concern yourself with what's down the path, you don't see what's in front of you. Our aim is always this moment, this breath. It's actually a relief when that finally seeps in and we stop worrying about how am I going to do? How are things coming out? What do people think of me? What's the teacher going to say? It's to have that drop away, to just settle into this moment. And number four, don't cling to anything, don't reject anything. Let come what comes and accommodate yourself to that, whatever it is. If good mental images arise, that is fine. If bad mental images arise, that is fine too. Look on all of it as equal and make yourself comfortable with whatever happens. Don't fight with your experience. Just observe it all mindfully. Number five, let go. Learn to flow with all the changes that come up. Loosen up and relax. We do better when we loosen up and relax. There isn't any state that we can get to that's going to be permanent. We have to learn to flow with the changes because they'll never stop. Things are always changing. The mind is never settled into one particular configuration. I never surfed, but I imagine it's hard to surf if you're stiff. Number six, accept everything that arises. Accept your feelings, even the ones you wish you did not have. Hard to do. Accept your experiences, even the ones you hate. Don't condemn yourself for having human flaws and failings. Learn to see all the phenomena in the mind as being perfectly natural and understandable. Try to exercise a disinterested acceptance at all times with respect to everything you experience. Accept everything that arises. Accept yourself. And not only that, we need to expand. We need to accept others. Of course, it always goes hand in hand. The people who are most judgmental of other people are the ones who have the most trouble accepting weaknesses in themselves. Sometimes they would say, well, it's not a problem. I don't have very many weaknesses. I'm such a wonderful person. But always, acceptance begins with humility, with the realization that we are deeply flawed, that our habits of mind are totally unskillful. So one of the first fruits of practice is to see that. People don't like it, but there it is. And once you see that in yourself, how can you be critical of others? Even people who seem to be deliberately disingenuous, self-serving, hypocritical, there's always something there. There's always a way that came about. Why shouldn't people be the way they are? Who are we to say, no, you should be different? It extends to terrorists in the Mideast. It extends even as far as conservative politicians. It's always a danger sign when we find ourselves getting outraged, indignant. Acceptance needs to go really, really deep. It's famously Master Rinzai, Linchi, said, there is nothing that I do not like. Zen is really the school of radical acceptance. Doesn't mean that we don't work to change things. Doesn't mean that we don't have preferences. Just accept things as they are in this moment, because they can't be any other way. It's what is. Number 7, be gentle with yourself. Be kind to yourself. You may not be perfect, but you're all you've got to work with. The process of becoming who you will be begins first with the total acceptance of who you are. Kind of said this. But this reminds me of my own experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, in AA. That moment when you truly take in your weakness, your imperfection, your so-called failure, it really frees you up. You know, people who haven't failed, who still feel they're, have a lot to be proud about, it makes them brittle. It makes them fragile. It makes them unable to let go. So they have something to protect. It's actually extremely liberating to not have anything that you have to pretend to. Way back when, I read a book about some strange Buddhist practice. I think it was in China. It involved, or maybe it was Tibetan, I don't know. It involved somehow rather softening the top of your head, and at the end of this process they would be able to insert a little blade of grass or something. It was sort of goofy stuff that I read back then. But the interesting thing from the whole story was there were a whole group of people, and everybody, going through this process was apparently able to accomplish whatever it was they were trying to do, except for one person who was a Zen practitioner and had recently had Kensho. And they finally got it, but there was that element of pride that got in the way. Point number 8, investigate yourself. Question everything. Take nothing for granted. Don't believe anything because it sounds wise and pious and some holy man said it. This is almost directly from the mouth of the Buddha. See for yourself. That does not mean that you should be cynical, impudent, or irreverent. It means you should be empirical. Subject all statements to the actual test of your own experience, and let the results be your guide to truth. Meditation evolves out of an inner longing to wake up to what is real and to gain liberating insight into the true structure of existence. The entire practice hinges upon this desire to be awake to the truth. Without it, the practice is superficial. This is the motivation behind koan practice, working on mu or who am I. It comes out of that desire to know, to see. Not to get something, to see for yourself, your own truth. Number 9, he's got a lot of these. Number 9, view all problems as challenges. Look upon negativities that arise as opportunities to learn and grow. Don't run from them, condemn yourself, or bury yourself in saintly silence. You have a problem? Great. More grist for the mill. Rejoice, dive in, and investigate. A lot of people know that grist for the mill was probably a favorite phrase of Roshi Kaplow, and his gravesite, just up the hill there, there's a millstone right at the head of his grave. It's quite fitting. It's just a simple change in attitude from something being a problem to something for that you can work on, for it to be grist for the mill. View all problems as challenges. Number 10, don't ponder. You don't need to figure everything out. Discursive thinking won't free you from the trap. In meditation, the mind is purified naturally by wordless, bare attention. Habitual deliberation is not necessary to eliminate those things that are keeping you in bondage. All that is necessary is a clear, non-conceptual perception of what they are and how they work. That alone is sufficient to dissolve them. Concepts and reasoning just get in the way. Don't think. See. Yeah, the thinking mind is just something that we stumble over in meditation. There's a place for thinking, of course. But problem solving through thought is not going to get you where you want to get in meditation. It's not going to leave you here. It's always involving duality, looking outside yourself, and playing with thoughts. Just to give Anthony DeMello his say here. Not going to go into his history. He was a Catholic priest from was born in India. But this is really, really saying very much the same thing. He says, how are you going to understand what you disapprove of or what you approve of, for that matter? All of this sounds like a new world, doesn't it? No judgment, no commentary, no attitude. One simply observes, one studies, one watches, without the desire to change what is. Because if you desire to change what is into what you think should be, you no longer understand. You could say you're no longer intimate. A dog trainer attempts to understand a dog so that he can train the dog to perform certain tricks. A scientist observes the behavior of ants, with no further end in view than to study ants, to learn as much as possible about them. He has no other aim. He's not attempting to train them or get anything out of them. He's interested in ants. He wants to learn as much as possible about them. That's his attitude. The day you attain a posture like that, you will experience a miracle. You will change, effortlessly, correctly. Change will happen. You will not have to bring it about. As the life of awareness settles on your darkness, whatever is evil will disappear. Whatever is good will be fostered. You'll have to experience that for yourself. But this calls for a disciplined mind. And when I say disciplined, I'm not talking about effort. I'm talking about something else. Have you ever studied an athlete? His or her whole life is sports, but what a disciplined life he or she leads. And look at a river as it moves towards the sea. It creates its own banks that contain it. When there's something within you that moves in the right direction, it creates its own discipline. The moment you get bitten by the bug of awareness. Oh, it's so delightful. It's the most delightful thing in the world, the most important, the most delightful. There's nothing so important in the world as awakening. Nothing. And of course, It is also discipline in its own way. Really, the attitude both these guys are talking about is fostered by faith. Faith in the practice, faith in ourselves. Maybe it's faith in the universe. A lot of people struggle with that. But it doesn't have to be faith in believing a concept or a catechism. Can come in with our reservations, and just by putting it to the test, actually doing this practice as we're instructed, finding out where we're going wrong and making the correction if necessary, we come to have our faith grows. And we realize there's nothing more wonderful that we could be doing. And our faith is confirmed when it starts to make a difference in the way we relate to and treat other people. Roshi is fond of saying, we do this practice to become vehicles of service. But, despite that high-minded sentiment, it's pretty enjoyable. It's pretty enjoyable to just be with things as they are, not to be casting our mind ahead, not to be plagued with anxiety, shame, frustration. And when we are plagued with those things, to be able to just look at them, to see them. All those negative feelings aren't something that we have to get rid of. They're grist for the mill. Okay, coming back to Gunaratana. Skipping a couple chapters ahead. This is a chapter that's entitled What to Do with Your Mind. And just sort of diving in here, he says, the mind is tricky. Thought is an inherently complicated procedure. By that we mean that we become trapped, wrapped up, and stuck in the thought chain. One thought leads to another, which leads to another, and another, and another, and so on. 15 minutes later, we suddenly wake up and realize we spent that whole time stuck in a daydream or sexual fantasy or a set of worries about our bills or whatever. Roshi once in a session was talking about getting caught in a thought chain. It's like you've turned off the interstate onto the exit ramp. And then instead of waking up and getting right back on, you find yourself taking a right turn and winding down into town, and you run through town, and then you find yourself in a trailer by the river. We can get pretty far afield, but the return is instantaneous. All we have to do is to recognize, oh, and come back. It doesn't even require, oh, I'm an idiot, come back. He says, there's a difference between being aware of a thought and thinking a thought. The difference is very subtle. It is primarily a matter of feeling or texture. A thought you are simply aware of with bare attention feels light in texture. There's a sense of distance between the thought and the awareness viewing it. It arises lightly like a bubble, and it passes away without necessarily giving rise to the next thought in that chain. Normal consciousness, conscious thought, however, is much heavier in texture. It's ponderous, commanding, and compulsive. Compulsive is the right word. It sucks you in and grabs control of consciousness. By its very nature, it is obsessional, and it leads straight to the next thought in the chain with apparently no gap between them. It's true of thoughts. It's also true of feelings. Anger is a great example. Such a huge difference when we can become aware that we are angry. It's quite remarkable. When righteous rage really sweeps over you, you're just not in any way aware of the fact of the anger that's surging through your body, not aware of the bodily sensations even. You're so focused on the object of your anger. The incredible impertinence, the self-serving duplicity. How could they possibly be that way? And in that moment, you're just completely, completely lost. Just the slight switch to seeing your anger, to knowing, okay, that guy is a jerk. He is an asshole. But I also notice that I'm angry. You know, that's a tremendous amount of progress. And anything where we can know what's going on in our own mind is going to give us space to move, give us a little maneuverability, and make us less conditioned, less compulsive. Everybody here has the experience of getting lost in a train of thought. But as we practice, as we let go of thoughts when we recognize them, the spaces become larger. We have periods where we're just looking, just breathing, just questioning. Sometimes those thoughts are practically unconscious. And this ties in with what he said earlier about attitude. A lot of times there's some small little thought about how well I'm doing, how soon am I going to get there, am I any good? We have these sort of thoughts where we check in on ourselves and you may not even know that you're doing it. And what it does is it interrupts your clarity. It interrupts your direct looking. It's hard to avoid going there. It's hard to avoid stepping back and looking, stepping back and checking. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Because it's a habit. Anything that we've done over and over and over again, we're going to continue to do. Practice can't make that stop like it slammed into a wall and now it's gone. You can just weaken it slowly. Notice it, let go of it. Notice it, let go of it. He says, conscious thought sets up a corresponding tension in the body, such as muscular contraction or a quickening of the heartbeat, but you won't feel tension until it grows to actual pain, because normal conscious thought is also greedy. It grabs all your attention and leaves none to notice its own effect. The difference between being aware of the thought and thinking the thought is very real, but it is extremely subtle and difficult to see. Concentration is one of the tools needed to be able to see this difference. He says, deep concentration has the effect of slowing down the thought process and speeding up the awareness viewing it. We notice more quickly. The result is an enhanced ability to examine the thought process. Now, in Vipassana practice, a lot more is done with looking at, teasing apart the contents of the mind. In Zen, it's a bit simpler. Notice the thought, let it go. But in both, concentration is really the key. He says, we use the focus of attention to achieve one-pointedness of mind with calm and constantly applied attention. Without a fixed reference point, you get lost, overcome by the ceaseless waves of change flowing around and around within the mind. We use our breath as our focus. It serves as that vital reference point from which the mind wanders and is drawn back. Distraction cannot be seen as distraction unless there is some central focus to be distracted from. This is why Shikantaza is such a difficult practice, where you don't have that reference point, whether it's a koan or the breath. And this also, this business of having a reference point, it's the reason why in the beginning of breath practice we count the breath. Because it makes an even more noticeable reference point. If we've lost the count, it's a pretty good sign that we've been distracted by thoughts. It's possible to get into a state where you're kind of aware of the breathing, or you're kind of aware of the koan, and yet a whole thought chain is going on in the background or the foreground. Sometimes it's hard to tell which is in the background and which is in the foreground. Always need to be bringing more and more of our attention, our awareness, to the practice itself. These two parallel, sort of two wings of a bird, our concentration and our mindfulness, our awareness of what's happening with the mind. Not sure how much sense it means it has to call them two different things, two different aspects of our practice. Sometimes the concentration is in the foreground, sometimes the awareness of where we've gone astray is in the foreground, depending on what's needed. It says, ancient Pali texts liken meditation to the process of taming a wild elephant. The procedure in those days was to tie a newly captured animal to a post with a good strong rope. When you do this, the elephant is not happy. He screams and tramples and pulls against the rope for days. Finally, it sinks through his skull that he can't get away, and he settles down. Ask you to suspend your pity at what isn't a very pleasant training process for the elephant. At this point, you can begin to feed him and to handle him with some measure of safety. Eventually, you can dispense with the rope and post altogether and train your elephant for various tasks. Now you've got a tamed elephant that can be put to useful work. In this analogy, the wild elephant is your wildly active mind, the rope is mindfulness, and the post is your object of meditation, your breathing. The tamed elephant who emerges from this process is a well-trained, concentrated mind that can then be used for the exceedingly tough job of piercing the layers of illusion that obscure reality. Meditation tames the mind. Why choose breathing as the primary object of meditation? Why not use something a bit more interesting? Answers to this are numerous. A useful object of meditation should be one that promotes mindfulness. It should be portable, easily available, and cheap. It should also be something that will not embroil us in those states of mind from which we are trying to free ourselves, such as greed, anger, and delusion. Breathing satisfies all these criteria and more. Breathing is something common to every human being. We all carry it with us wherever we go. It is always there, constantly available, never ceasing from birth till death, and it costs nothing. Breathing is a non-conceptual process, a thing that can be experienced directly without a need for thought. Furthermore, it is a very living process, an aspect of life that is in constant change. The breath moves in cycles, inhalation, exhalation, breathing in and breathing out, and thus it is a miniature model of life itself. The sensation of breath is subtle, yet it is quite distinct when you learn to tune into it. It takes a bit of effort to find it, yet anyone can do it. You've got to work at it, but not too hard. For all these reasons, breathing makes an ideal object of meditation. Breathing is normally an involuntary process, proceeding at its own pace without a conscious will, yet a single act of will can slow it down or speed it up, make it long and smooth or short and choppy. The balance between involuntary breathing and forced manipulation of breath is quite delicate, and there are lessons to be learned here on the nature of will and desire. Breath is a phenomenon common to all living things. A true experiential understanding of the process moves you closer to other living beings. It shows you your inherent connectedness with all of life. Nakagawa Roshi used to say, "We're all members of the same nose-hole society." The nose-hole sangha. And not only us human beings, all animals, at least the ones that run around on land. There's also a gill society, which we were part of when we were in the womb. Finally, breathing is a present moment process. By that we mean it is always occurring in the here and now. We don't normally live in the present, of course. We spend most of our time caught up in memories of the past or looking ahead to the future, full of worries and plans. Breath has none of that other timeness. When we truly observe the breath, we are automatically placed in the present. We are pulled out of the morass of mental images and into a bare experience of the here and now. In this sense, breath is a living slice of reality, a mindful observation of such a miniature model of life itself. A mindful observation of such a miniature model of life itself leads to insights that are broadly applicable to the rest of our experience. It's the nature of the breath, and it's the nature of practice. It's always there. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.